From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I'm the king of rock, there is none higher. Sucker MCs should call me sire. To burn my kingdom, you must choose fire. I won't stop rocking till I retire. Now we rock the party.
It's Hip Hop Week on Fresh Air. Throughout the week, we're featuring interviews with some of the most important rappers and DJs of the past 30 years. Today, we'll hear from hip-hop entrepreneur Russell Simmons, the co-founder of Def Jam Records, and we'll talk with three rappers who launched their careers with Simmons' help. Daryl McDaniels co-founded Run DMC with Simmons' brother Run. Russell Simmons managed the group, and they made the first rap record to go platinum. LL Cool J made Def Jam's first record, and Chuck D co-founded the politically charged group Public Enemy, which recorded on Def Jam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Hip Hop Week on Fresh Air. Throughout the week, we're featuring interviews with some of the most important rappers and DJs of the past 30 years. All the rappers we'll hear from today, Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC, Chuck D of Public Enemy, and LL Cool J, launched their careers with the help of my first guest, Russell Simmons. He's probably the most famous and successful hip-hop entrepreneur and helped bring rap to the mainstream. In the mid-1980s, he co-founded Def Jam Records with music producer Rick Rubin. Here's just a few of Def Jam's hits.
I'm going back to Cali, Cali, Cali. I'm going back to Cali. I don't think so. Going back to Cali, styling, profiling, smiling and smiling while in the sun. The top is down on the black Corvette, and it's fly cause it's sitting on me.
Brass monkey, that funky monkey. Brass monkey, junkie, that funky monkey.
Well, it was one of those days,
not much to do.
I was chilling downtown
with my old school crew.
I went into a store
to buy a slice of pizza
and bumped into a girl.
Her name was Mona. What?
Mona Lisa.
What?
Mona Lisa, so many.
So some stay illiterate and feeble, legally licked to go the ways of the weasel.
The weasel. Pop, pop goes the weasel, the weasel. Pop, pop goes the weasel, the weasel. Pop, pop goes the weasel, the weasel. Pop goes the weasel, cause the weasel goes pop.
The minute they see me, fear me, I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
M-E-T-H-O-D, man. M-E-T-H-O-D, man. M-E-T-H-O-D, man.
Just hit the east side of the LBC. A mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweak. All of you search, know what's up with 213.
This is how we do it. It's Friday night and I feel alright. The party's here on the west side, so I reach for my 40 and I turn it.
Before starting Def Jam, Russell Simmons produced rap concerts and managed performers including Curtis Blow and Run DMC. Simmons' younger brother, known as Run, co-founded the group. In 1999, Simmons sold his stake in Def Jam to the Universal Music Group for $100 million. He remains CEO of Rush Communications. When I spoke with Simmons in 2001, I asked what his reaction was in 1979 when he heard the first commercial rap record, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang.
Hip hop, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, rubber to the boogity bang bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am...
1979, that record came out, and I was very distraught because I didn't know any better, and I had a record on the shelf by the name of Christmas Rapping, which was the first release that I was involved with by Curtis Blow. And so, you know, I didn't have the vision to know that this was an eye-opener for America or opened the door for me. I just thought that these guys had stolen my, you know, not my idea, but I had a record on the shelf, and I wanted it to be the first rap record. So when I heard it, I kind of, not only was I upset, but so was the whole hip-hop community, because there was a group of artists, DJ Hollywood, Eddie Cheever, the great Grandmaster Flash, Curtis Blow, Love Bug Starsky. These guys were the stars of that genre, and they were performing artists. Now, here's a recording artist record by people who were not popular, who borrowed ideas and rhymes from this community and put it on record. So we were all, like, bummed out because we thought these guys had stolen our music, our ideas, and our, you know, our culture, and they were selling it, and we weren't. So I didn't realize that Rapper's Delight was the greatest thing that could have happened to me.
How was it the greatest thing?
Well, because it allowed people to understand that there was profit in rap music. And then it gave Curtis Blow an opportunity to put out his record. I had a Curtis Blow record on the shelf. Again, that record was named Christmas Rapping. It plays every Christmas right now.
Why don't we play it now? Introduce it for us. Tell us something about what you think made this record special.
Well, it was probably the second rap record to come out. and it was, you know, a very, very commercial version of hip-hop, but it certainly, it was honest. It was a hip-hopper who was from Harlem. It was the real thing and had it built a legitimate following on his own as a performing artist. And whenever I hear it, I get goosebumps because that was my first experience of being in the record business, which was something, of course, I aspired to and, you know, only dreamed about.
Okay, so this is Christmas Rapping. It's Russell Simmons' first record production and Curtis Blow's first recording.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the
hold
house...
Hold it now, wait, hold it. That's played out. Hit it!
Don't you give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive. Cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know. So every year, just about this time, I celebrate it with a rhyme. Gonna shake it, gonna bake it, gonna make it good. Gonna rock, shock, knock it through your neighborhood. Gonna read, gonna sing it till it's understood. My rapping about to happen like a knee you been slapping, or a toe you been tapping on a hunk of wood. Bought a red suited dude with a friendly attitude and a sleigh full of goodies for the people on the block. Got a long white beard, maybe looks kinda weird, and if you ever see him, he can give you quite a shock."
That's Curtis Blow's Christmas Rappin', produced by my guest Russell Simmons, who has a new memoir, which is called Life and Death. Now, when you started getting successful, and when some of the performers you were producing, like Curtis Blow, started getting successful, Run DMC, it meant money. Making money quickly at a young age can be a very good thing. It could also be a very destructive thing, because sometimes people aren't prepared to deal with that kind of money, and it gets them into more trouble than it has benefits. Looking back, what are some of the things you think you did right and wrong when you started coming into money?
Well, I think that I already was like a big old druggie. Like whatever drug came my way, I took. I was already running the street. The success or the money, the results of the success, I don't think it damaged me too much. You know, I mean, it gave me opportunity and access. Some of the access was a little bit of a problem. But I think that mostly I had a good time, and I think that the money for me was, you know, just gave me more incentive in a way. It was kind of a measure of success. But I did see many artists who got addicted to drugs and whose careers suffered because of this quick access and this amount of money that was, you know, for them an unreasonable amount of money for the work that they did. People did the work for the love of it, and when they started to get a lot of money for it, they lost focus, many of us. And so, at some point, you know, I just straightened up, and it was kind of an evolution, but it was just, I don't think that the money for me was a problem. I mean, it gave me the opportunity to get an apartment. I remember when Christmas Rapping was a hit, for instance, the greatest success that I can remember to date is that I got a record out. I got a chance to get on a plane and go to Amsterdam, which for me was an amazing experience. I had never been on a plane at all. I went to Amsterdam in 1979 with Curtis Blow. We were treated like, well, we thought we were kings. We got to go to Amsterdam and perform, and we saw people, you know, from other countries, not only Amsterdam, but we went to France, Paris, France specifically, and these people watched us perform, and here we were in this big world with our own music. And when I came back to New York, I was moving into my own apartment. That apartment is probably no bigger than the studios I'm here recording from. But I was in the record business, which was what I wanted to be, and that was a tremendous success, just the ability to go to work every day in an industry that I loved.
As a teenager, you were dealing drugs and making money that way. Did you learn anything in the business of dealing drugs that you were able to apply when you became a real businessman?
Well, I can tell you that it inspired me to buy for one and sell for two. And that's something that in the black community, we didn't have very many role models who are entrepreneurs. It's just now that hip-hop is inspiring so many young people, many of whom are not so educated or sophisticated, but are driven by incentive and, I mean, by love of music and art, and who own their own, and there are big margins in some of these businesses, and they just go to work every day without you know, a business school background, without a degree from Harvard or wherever, to just go to work from heart. It's something that was not instilled in kids in the black community. Their job was to be a doctor, maybe, but be a teacher, probably. Just to go to school was the goal. You know, rappers rap now about being CEOs. They don't even rap sometimes about how good a rapper they are. They rap a lot more about how much they can stack money and how they do it, you know, how they run their businesses.
Now, do you think of yourself as having done business any differently with Def Jam than you saw business being done in the major record labels that you had tried to deal with?
Absolutely. We had this vision that these artists were long-term, that they had images of that had to be protected, that they were not going to be exploitative in terms of the kind of music they put out. We weren't going to change their music so it would sell more. We weren't going to sell them out or allow them to sell themselves out. We wanted to remind them to keep their integrity and promote that. We wanted to make sure that their images, their visual images, were out in the street, not just their music. There was a lot of work that we did that was different from what major labels would have done, and it gave us an edge over them, because even now, LL Cool J, who was our first act, and we recorded his record in 84, is recording a new record, and his last record was a platinum-selling record. Even now, there's a new Run DMC record being recorded, and their first record was recorded in 1982. Beastie Boys are still recording. There's a new Public Enemy record. Slick Rick is still coming out. There's a new EPMD record. These are the bands we started with. You can always fool people one time or a few times, but to really have a long-standing career, you have to connect with them in some real place.
Have you ever been concerned about the promotion of a gangster lifestyle through rap, making it cool to think of women as bitches, making it cool to think of shooting people in drive-bys and the gang life?
You know, I'm often asked this question.
I figured. And,
and people are always surprised to know that I'm really proud of all of what rap stands for today. And I believe that what people say in their closed doors, they're shocked to hear it on the radio. They're shocked to hear a reflection of this reality, you know, broadcast. I heard a senator say at the hearings on the Marketing Accountability Act, and Senator Thompson, a Republican senator, said he thought that every 15-year-old boy should see Saving Private Ryan, because he thought that if they all saw that, they'd know a lot about the war and about, you know, that lifestyle that you have to, or that attitude that you know have to have in order to live through war, and it was important. Well, I said, well, in that case, every 15-year-old kid must hear a Snoop Dogg record, because that's a war going on down the block. And that's not 50 years ago, that's right now. And that's something that it's very important. When they say F the police, or when they said it in Compton in 1985, that was such an important record. I remember signing a band in L.A., and they were just nice kids, basically, but lived in a horrible part of L.A. And they came to visit me at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they asked me how to get home. I said, what do you mean, how do you get home? How'd you? And I said, they're afraid of the police. I said, well, why are you afraid of the police? What are you carrying? Do you have guns? Do you have drugs? No, we don't have anything. We're just afraid of the police. These are 20-year-old men, scared to drive in Beverly Hills. Almost all the records that people perceive as gangster records are about people frustrated who don't perceive themselves as having any other opportunity, and it's a description of their lifestyle more than it is an endorsement of it. And so that's something that, you know, people who listen closely to the music can tell, and people from the outside, all they can hear is the language. Well, real language is okay by me, and descriptions of real situations and a real reflection of our society, a part of our society, is important by me.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russell Simmons co-founded Def Jam Records and is the CEO of Rush Communications. Our interview was recorded in 2001. Coming up, we hear from Daryl McDaniels, co-founder of Run DMC. This is Fresh Air. Russell Simmons co-founded Def Jam Records after the success he had managing Run DMC. Run was Simmons' younger brother. DMC, Daryl McDaniels, is our next guest. Run DMC had its first hit, It's Like That, in 1983. By 1985, they'd become the first rap group to earn a gold or a platinum album. They were also the first rap group to have their videos played on MTV and the first to appear on the cover of Rolling Stone. In 2002, Run DMC lost member Jam Master Jay when he was shot and killed in a recording studio in Queens. McDaniels now performs solo. I spoke to him in 1997. Here's one of Run DMC's hits.
Yo, Jay. Wait.
What?
Wait. Day when I was chilling in Kentucky Fried Chicken, just minding my business, eating food and finger licking. This dude walked in, looking strange and kind of funny. Went up to the front with a menu and his money. He didn't walk straight, kind of side to side. He asked this old lady,
yo, yo, is this Kentucky Fried?
The lady said, yeah, smiling. He smiled back. He gave a quarter and his order.
Small fry.
How did you first hear rap?
Wow, that's a good question. The first time I ever heard rap was back in 1970. I think it was either 76 or 78. There was a radio show. It was like an underground radio show, and the disc jockey's name was Eddie Chiba. And the station was in New York. It was WFUV. And that was the first time I ever heard rap. He had a rhyme where he said, when you mess around in New York town, you go down with the disco Chiba clown. You go down, go down, go down, go down, you go down. You know, it was really simple. But the first time I ever heard rap was back in 76 or 78 on WFUV DJ Eddie Chiba.
And what were your very early rhymes like?
Oh, well, my very early rhymes were, basically simple, talking about I had the best rhymes, nobody had more rhymes than me, my DJ was the best DJ, we had the loudest sound system, it was simple stuff like C to an apple, apple to a core, I am the man with the rhymes galore, rock a rhyme for me, rock a rhyme for you, and everybody catch the boogaloo flu, Hollis, Queens is where I'm from, don't be stupid, don't be so dumb. So it's basically boasting about my neighborhood, me being the best MC, and nobody can take me out.
Speaking of your neighborhood, you're from Hollis, Queens.
Yes.
In New York, and the two other members of Run DMC are from the same neighborhood, I think.
Yes.
And you went to school together, right? You knew each other before you were a group.
Yeah, definitely. We all lived in five blocks of each other. We went to elementary and high school and college together.
So when did you actually form Run DMC? Where were you in your school years?
Well, me and Run first started rhyming and DJing together in my basement. I actually taught Run how to DJ. He was rapping first, then I taught him how to DJ, how to do the quick mix and how to spin records back and how to blend two of the same records together. So Run and DMC was like formed back in around 1980. We started DJing in my basement, and then when he got better equipment to me for Christmas, so we started DJing in his attic. So I would say Run DMC was formed right then. And then as the group, it was 1982 when we put together It's Like That and That's the Way It Is as Sucker MCs, which was our first single. And then we needed a DJ, and that's when we got Jam Master Jay, who was the neighborhood DJ. He was like the best DJ in the neighborhood. Jay would set up his equipment in the park, and he'd plug it into the light post, and then we would play until a cops would come and stop us. So actually, we came together as a professional group in 1982.
And were you in high school and college?
We was all in college. We was all in our first semester of college.
Did you leave college once you started performing?
Yep, we took a leave of absence and been absent ever since.
What were your parents' reaction to taking a leave of absence to perform? Did they think you were making a big mistake?
No, they was mad. They was like, are you crazy? What are you doing? And, even when they got a hint of, me wanting to be a rapper as my career, as my job, you know, they was telling me stuff like, it's ridiculous. You better stay in school, and we're not paying all this money for you to go to St. John's for nothing. And as a matter of fact, when I went to record our first single, I didn't tell my parents because I knew they wouldn't have let me go. So they was outraged, you know.
How did they find out?
Well, I had to come tell them where I was at for the last 15 hours, you know, because I just left the house. It was a Sunday afternoon. I left the house about 1 o'clock, and I ain't come home in the morning until the next morning, like 5 a.m. in the morning.
Did you play them the record? Did they like it?
Yeah, I played them the record, and they didn't really like it till they heard it on the radio.
No, was that It's Like That?
Yeah, that was It's Like That.
Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC. Our interview was recorded in 1997. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and here's that first Run DMC hit.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Too black, too strong. Too black, too strong.
Yo, Chuck, these honey dribbles are still.
Coming up, Chuck D talks about Public Enemy's sound, look, and politically charged lyrics. Also, we hear from LL Cool J, who made Def Jam's first record and had several platinum albums, and we continue our conversation with Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1997 interview with Daryl McDaniels, co-founder of Run DMC, the first rap group to earn a gold or a platinum album, and the first to have their video played on MTV. Now, when you started performing, it was the big gold chain era.
Right. Actually, we started that.
Yeah, there's some great pictures of you with giant big gold chains. Yeah.
Like when we were saying Russell was a big part of that, Jay was always dressing like that. The way Run DMC dressed, Jay always dressed like that. So when Russell seen Jay, he said, that's how you're going to dress. And that's when the gold chains came into play. Jay had a gold chain before he even thought of me in Run DMC. Jay wore chains like that when he was in high school.
What do you think it did for your image back then?
What it actually did showed that we had money. You know, it showed that we had the big gold chain and the fancy car and that we were truly the superstars of the neighborhood. You know, because if you got a big chain and the other guy don't, you must be doing something. And, you know, it also brought a bad image to us because people that didn't know Run DMC before we had an album cover out thought we was just drug dealers. because most of the drug dealers was wearing chains like that and driving in big cars, even before the rappers made it big.
You were teenagers when you started performing. How did you handle fame when it first hit you and you were still in your teens?
Oh, man, fame hit us so quick. I mean, it's like now we got this thing that we say that certain periods in our career we can't remember, and we call it dazing. It was just like we was just in a daze. It was just like everything happened so quick. You know, the first record, then we did the rap album, the first rap album to go gold because nobody thought rap was going to sell. Then right after that, we got the first video on MTV, and that was like really a precedent because the only black star that was actually playing on MTV was Michael Jackson. Then we got on in, and then when Rockbox, which was the video that got on MTV, went into heavy rotation, rustling everybody down at the record company and at Rush Management was all excited. Y'all on MTV, and me and Runner J was like, what is MTV? Why are you guys so happy about this? And then the big tour, the Fresh Fresh Tour, and we was going around selling out Madison Square Garden and all the big venues. It all happened so fast that, you know, it's like it smacked us upside the head. You know, the money, the fame, and the fortune, it didn't go to our heads, but it smacked us upside our heads.
A lot of rap groups really brag about their neighborhood, often bragging about how tough it is.
Yeah.
What was your neighborhood like, Hollis, Queens?
Hollis, Queens was, you know, it was a middle-class, hard-working neighborhood. It had a lot of educated people there, but you also had, you know, violence and drugs and prostitution and murder and rape and robbery right on the corner. You know, it's just good that we came from good families who made sure we went to school, didn't play hooky, or run with the wrong crowd. So you had good and bad going on at the same time.
Now, did you ever feel like you had to cover up the fact that your neighborhood was pretty middle class and that your parents wouldn't let you play hooky?
Nah, it was no way we could hide it because that was something the reporters made known to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they thought it was a big thing. All right, here you got this rap group making all this money, running around talking about their cars and, you know, how good they are. And, you know, they're selling a lot of records. And, you know, it was a thing where rap was supposed to be only done by, you know, people from the ghetto, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, Grandmaster Flash and them, they came from the heart of the Bronx. And Afrika Bambaataa, they was from Bronx and Manhattan. They was from the ghetto, you know what I'm saying? Apartment buildings and broken glass everywhere. People was a subway. We came from Hollis, Queens, where you got separate houses, grass, backyards, cookout, Catholic school, and all this other stuff going on. But, you know, we wanted people to know, you know, my mother and father, Jay's mother and father, runs by hard-working, educated people. But then you had the people that, you know, lived in the middle of the block, you know, they had to rob and steal for the next meal. But a lot of the press wanted to emphasize, I guess they wanted to let the world know that these guys are fronting. They might look tough and they might talk tough on their record, but they're middle-class, Catholic school, nice guys.
Was there ever any pressure on you from producers or record companies to harden your image, to make it more hardcore?
No, but we felt pressure on ourselves. In 1990, we made an album called Back From Hell. And on this Back From Hell album, it was like the first album we ever really used profanity. And it was like the first album we ever really came at everybody else in the industry. It was, you know, the first album where we kind of degraded women. You know, we didn't really talk bad like most records did, but we started talking. We started, you know, straying that way. And that was like one of our worst albums. So we learned a big lesson from that. I mean, that album was like a flop for Run DMC. It only sold maybe 250,000 copies. That was the year everybody was saying Run DMC was over. You know what I'm saying? Because we strayed from what we was really about. Even though we were still doing live shows, we made this album, which was trying to go with the flow of the times.
Mm-hmm.
When keeping it real is being real to yourself and staying who you are.
Now, I know that you're Christian. Was there like a change in your life where you were born again?
Right around that time. I mean, you know, the records wasn't selling. Everybody was saying we was over. Run was smoking a lot of reefer. I was drinking a lot of beer. Things wasn't well within the group. You know, people was like saying, yo, Run DMC is over. You know, their time is over. And that was like really a down time. And, you know, with anybody, when it's time to well, not time. When you are down and out on your deathbed, I don't care who you are, you're going to scream out to God, you know, and he's going to answer, and it's up for you to answer his calling. And, you know, basically, there was nowhere else we could turn but to God. You know, God help us. You know, and we was like, yo, we're very thankful for everything that happened and this and that. And if only we could, you know, just get, you know, get back to what we was all about. But we had to make that adjustment in our minds ourselves. You know what I'm saying? But it was like really a down time. I mean, the women, it was like the worst time for Run DMC of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, all that stuff that you think, when I'm not going to go that way, I'm not going to happen to us. And it was like really a bad time for us.
One of the things that you've done in some of your records is take sample things from rock and heavy metal. Mm-hmm. One of your most famous records, Walk This Way, uses the famous Aerosmith recording on it. And I'm wondering if you feel like that exposed you to audiences that rap records might not have otherwise reached.
Most definitely. Most definitely, it exposed us to, you know, although at the same time, we was already on MTV. But the reason why we made a lot of rock records is because before rap records was made, we used to have to find things to rap over. And rock and roll had a lot of drum breaks and a lot of drum beats. And rock and roll had a lot of loud guitars. And rap was like an aggressive art form, and it was hard, so we had to find rock records. We couldn't rap over violins and flutes and soft stuff. We needed something hard, and we wanted to make a record using the Aerosmith beat. But Rick Rubin, who was our producer at the time, he was an Aerosmith fan back when it was large. He was like, oh, you don't know whose record that is you're rapping over, and they're the Aerosmith, and they was big when I was younger, and this and that. Hey, you know what y'all should do? Y'all should do their record over. Now, me and Run was real mad, because all we wanted to do was say our rhymes over that beat. Rick Rubin wanted us to learn Steven Tyler's lyrics. And we was like, oh, Rick, you're going to ruin our career and this and that. That's not going to work. You know, we're barely getting over by rapping, you know, doing our own lyrics over rock. Now you want us to do a cover of a rock song? But we did it, and it worked. And it opened up us to a whole wider audience.
Are you still wearing Adidas?
Yes. I'm sitting here with Adidas on from head to toe. And we're always wearing Adidas.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. We're out of time. I wish we weren't, but we got to go.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Daryl McDaniels co-founded Run DMC. He now performs solo. Our interview was recorded in 1997. Coming up, LL Cool J. This is Fresh Air. Def Jam Records' first release was the recording debut of a 16-year-old named LL Cool J. He went on to make several consecutive platinum records. He starred in the sitcom In the House and has appeared in several films. He's in the film Water, which will open the Toronto Film Festival next month. I spoke with LL Cool J in 1997, after the publication of his memoir. When he was a boy, he and his mother moved in with his grandparents in Queens, New York, after his mother left her violent husband. When LL Cool J was just 11, his grandparents bought him 2 turntables and a mixer so he could make demo tapes at home. His first hit, I Need a Beat, grew out of one of those home tapes. Let's hear it. Your grandmother gave you an ultimatum when you were in high school. Either you stay in school or you get out of the house.
She did.
So you ended up leaving the house. And you say you were homeless for a couple of weeks and you slept on the trains for a while until...
Yeah, I did.
Didn't you have any money yet?
No, I didn't. Actually, what happened was I recorded my first song. It did okay. And after I stopped doing the shows, I didn't have any income. So I had no money. I remember getting a room in Brooklyn that was $40 a week and struggling to keep it, you know, because it was just so hard to, you know, pay that $40 a week. And we had, you know, a bathroom that everybody in the brownstone shared. But it was real tough. So, no, the finances didn't really come until the first album.
Okay.
And even then, I didn't know what to do with the money. So it was, you know, it's kind of a strange paradox. You know, I started, you know, doing different things and doing different shows, but... because of the people that I was involved with and the people that were involved with my financial and economic life, I didn't, and myself, of course, I didn't benefit, you know, greatly from, you know, the money that was generated.
You had, like, the first big rap ballad, I Need Love. What made you think of doing a rap ballad?
I think that, for me, I always looked at rap music as a way to express, a vehicle to express my feelings and my emotions. You know, coming from a abusive childhood, rap music was a thing that helped me to feel empowered. It helped me to kind of feel a sense of power and a sense of self-worth that I wasn't feeling at home or wasn't feeling when I wasn't involved with rap music. So this art was an escape for me. I Need Love was just another expression of that. I was 17, 18 years old, and I really felt like I needed love. I felt like love was important. Being, you know, having gone through all the things that I had gone through. And I never looked at it as an opportunity to humble myself. I never looked at it as a chance to do something soft or sensitive. I just looked at it as a way to express my emotions on an artistic level. So I did what I really felt.
Well, this is LL Cool J, I Need Love.
When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call, telling me I need a girl who's as sweet as a dove. For the first time in my life, I see I need love. There I was, giggling about the games that I had played with many hearts, and I'm not saying no names. Then the thought occurred, teardrops made my eyes blurred, cause I said to myself, look what you've done to her. I can feel it inside, I can't explain how it feels. All I know is that I'm never dishing up the raw deal, playing make-believe, pretending that I'm true. Holding in my laugh as I say that I love you, saying I'm more, kissing you on the ear, whispering I love you and I'll always be here. Although I often reminisce, I can't believe that I found a desire for true love floating around inside my soul, because my soul is cold. One half of me deserves to be this way till I'm old, but the other half needs affection and joy and the warmth that is created by a girl and a boy. I need love.
LL Cool J recorded in 1987, I Need Love, and he's my guest, and he also has a new book, which is called I Make My Own Rules. Now, you know, it's interesting, you say in your book that there was a period of your career that when you were on tour, the tours were more like whoring, that, you know, that there was just like so much sex whoring. You were having with, you know.
A lot of whoring.
Yeah, with women waiting for you backstage and everybody wanted you. And I think, you know, that some of the rappers, and you're probably in this category, became so famous so quick, so young, and were so unused to having money and fame and admiration and all of that, that they just went wild.
You know what I really think? I think that it goes above and beyond. I don't think that this is a cultural issue or an economic issue, because I think that whether you're white, black, Asian, Latin, all musicians go through this. I think that especially ones that come in young, whether you're a rock musician or, you know, a reggae musician or a soul singer, I think it's just one of those things that comes with the territory, unless you had someone to kind of steer you in a different direction.
And I guess you didn't have that.
Not at that point, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you expect in several years to hear from women who say that you're the father of their children? You know, to have those kind of celebrated lawsuits?
You're not going to send me one, are you?
No.
All right.
That was not the motivation behind the question.
I know. I'm just teasing with you. No, I tried to be as responsible as I could in terms of things like that. And I hope that never happens. And, you know, what else can I say? You know, I've thought about it, though. It's definitely went across my mind a few times. Like, man, I wonder if somebody's going to come up to me with, like, 10-year-old triplets talking about,
right.
Yeah, this is eeny, meeny, and miney. And they're your kids. And I want to
check.
Eeny,
meeny, and miney, Jay. LL Cool J recorded in 1997.
Come on, man.
Coming up, Chuck D talks about Public Enemy. This is Fresh Air. Chuck D was the leader of Public Enemy, one of the vanguard rap groups of the 80s, known for its multi-layered mixes and politically charged lyrics. Their 1988 album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, was named the second greatest album in Spin Magazine's listing of the 100 greatest albums released since the magazine's founding in 1985. One of Public Enemy's best-known songs, Fight the Power, was used in Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing. Chuck D now hosts a program on the liberal radio network Air America. I spoke with him in 1997. Here's Public Enemy's Power to the People.
And you thought the beat slowed down? Come on! Turn me loose! Just turn it up! Power to the people, y'all! Internationally known on the microphone, making sure the brothers will never leave you alone. To my sisters, yes, we missed ya. Let's get it together, make a nation. You can bet on it, don't sleep in it, cause the troops go deep in it.
Chuck D, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, how are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm all right.
in your new book, you point out that most rap artists were born after 1967, whereas everyone in your group was born between 1958 and 61. How do you think that makes your point of view different in your lyrics?
I just think I was able to visualize the whole decade of the 60s, and I definitely was a recipient of all the surrounding events. So when 1986 came around, and it was the 10th year, I guess, of rap music, sort of, or the 7th year of recording, the topics were in me, and I didn't have to really go into trying to discover them in depth as much as, you know, some of the younger guys. So I went into something that that was relative to myself.
Public Enemy is also known for its layered sound mixes. How did that become a part of the group?
The processes of trying to invent something that was different, trying to be as diverse as possible, and coming from a background of many different musical styles, which we believe that hip-hop is a blend and a hybrid of all kinds of musics. And, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I was more into sports. So when I did listen to music and I listened to radio, I listened to pretty much AM pop radio. So you heard everything from the Rolling Stones to Lovin' Spoonful, Chicago, the Spinners, Elton John, things like that. So that combination allowed us to come up with weird layering blends.
Tell me about creating the image of Public Enemy, how you dressed, what you did on stage, what the look was on stage.
Well, the look was on stage was like kind of represent some of the look on the streets, but what the S1Ws had done is, you know, take a combination of a Fruit of Islam and Black Panther Party look with the berets and the black suits. And actually, they had dressed that way to be, you know, they were security for our mobile gigs that we used to have out in Long Island. You know, when we actually put this group together, myself and Hank Shockley thought that they would be a good component to the group to add a look, and that they did. Flavor and myself wore regular street gear. You know, we started out wearing these little clocks because that was the style of high school kids at the time. And then Flavor just kept, you know, wearing his clock as the clocks got bigger. I took my clock off after the first year. But, you know, the clock signified what time it was, which meant that, you know, you had to know what was happening.
So tell me more about the image of having bodyguards on stage.
Well, they wasn't really bodyguards. Security of the First World signified, well, it had a double meaning. It was like they would call themselves Security of the First World because, you know, we felt that we as black people were first world people. And security, you know, spoke up for the fact that our culture, our language, our whole background and known black background was taken away from us. And the Security of the First World were a symbol to present the fact that we would never allow it to, you know, happen again. And, you know, there was also a symbol because in the beginning, you know, the S1Ws held Uzis. And the Uzi signified the whole aspect of black culture was stolen with the threat of the gun used by the Western Hemisphere and the European civilization. And when they used the gun to abduct us from a land that we pretty much, you know, were peaceful and civil at, then we used it as a symbol as the S1Ws being the Security of the First World, not allowing this to happen again in symbol.
Were they real Uzis or fake Uzis?
Next question.
Uh-oh. Sorry, you can't answer that. Why can't you answer that?
Because I choose not to.
All right. You know, that's a kind of elaborate metaphor that you're using for the Uzis, but I think the way they've really been seen is these guys are really tough. They've got guns. They're really macho.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the way you'd see it if you were in the audience as opposed to an elaborate metaphor
I think number one is that, you know, people were shocked at that time. They had never seen black organization like this in that particular type of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, black men in uniforms, they don't look like they're in the Army or the U.S. Navy or anything. They just look like they're in it for themselves.
One of your most famous records was used for the soundtrack of Do the Right Thing, and that's Fight the Power, mm-hmm. Fight the Powers That Be. What power? Which power do you want people
powers,
to fight?
The powers in the black community is all those that control the black community from the outside going in. The powers of a lot of different things, economics, education, enforcement, you know, the powers that keep the black community remaining in the plantation state that it remains in. So with that in mind, you want to fight the powers to get that foot off your neck. And that's just your human right to get a foot off your neck.
What influence do you hope your lyrics have had on your listeners?
To be able to look at information clearly, disseminate it, and then use it for their own good.
Yet our best trained, best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
Our interview with Chuck D was recorded in 1997. Fresh Air's Hip Hop Week continues tomorrow. Today's edition was produced by Anne-Marie Baldonado with Ian Chillog and Sam Brigger. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Audrey Bentham is our engineer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
1989, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer. Music hitting your heart, cause I know you got soul.
Hey.
Listen if you're missing, y'all. Swinging while I'm singing.
Hey.
Giving what you're getting. Knowing what I'm knowing. While the black band's sweating. In the rhythm, I'm rolling. Got to give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death.
We got to fight the powers that be.
Fight the power. Fight the power.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Entrepreneur Media, publisher of Entrepreneur's eBay Startup Guide, featuring resources for starting an online business on newsstands now. And from the Everett Foundation, saluting the Alliance for Justice and its work to advance the cause of justice for all Americans at allianceforjustice.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Original gangster.
On the next Fresh Air, our hip-hop week continues with two of the originators of gangster rap, Ice-T and Ice Cube. They've both gone on to successful acting careers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Years ago, I used to listen to rappers flow, talking about the way they rock the mic at the disco. I like how that was going down. Dreamt about